French. I just thought that.
Okay, so I'm gonna open up the page right now. I think you probably knew it was inevitable that we were going to, and I per the request I get every week, I'm gonna mute everybody. I think it was sort of assumed and inevitable and appropriate that we dedicate our learning today and our shiur today to the memory of Moreinu, really, Rabbi Norman Lamb, Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb Zatzal, who was an amazing leader and who did tremendous things for Klal Yisrael. I think it's safe to say he's one of the, if not the major shepherd in leading American Orthodoxy from where it was in the 1950s. And I don't think any of us are old enough, maybe, I'm certainly not, to remember what it was like then, but to know that American Orthodoxy in the 1950s was in retreat and was not only a minority, but was considered to be an antedated minority that was on its way out. And within the traditional world, read Marshall Sklar, but within the traditional world, conservative Judaism was on the rise and was, you know, ascendant. And from his pulpit in Springfield, but then when he not only became the pulpit rabbi at the Jewish Center, which he was for nearly 30 years, and as a professor at YU, and as the first editor of Tradition, and as the author of some amazing articles and books, Rabbi Lamb really helped guide the modern Orthodox community from its place there to where it is now, which is as a very vibrant and robust community with, I don't know how many more times the members and institutions that we had back then, and where we can stand proudly with our fellow Jews as representing Torah appropriately. And I would like to think that Rabbi Lamb, with whom I had a very nice relationship, a very, you know, small relationship, but a very cherished one, would enjoy this year. I certainly hope so. And so in his memory. This week is Parshat Naso here in the States. So for those of you in Israel, this you can shore this up for next year, but really not, because we're not going to talk about Parshat Naso. We're not even going to talk about the Haftarah of Parshat Naso. We're going to talk about is something that's tangentially related, so that we're, none of us are really off base, because none of us are fully on base, and that is the story of Shimshon. The reason I get to the story of Shimshon is because Shimshon is a fascinating character, very interesting character. I think much more of a tragic character and a failure as a character than a heroic character. But Shimshon is perhaps the most famous of the guerrilla leaders, the militia leaders in the Book of Shoftim. And last year we talked about Shimshon and about whether he really was even a Nazir, which, by the way, is the reason that the Perek Yud Gimel of Shoftim, which is the annunciation of the birth of Shimshon, the whole story that leads up to that is the Haftarah Naso, is because the story about a Nazir. Question is whether Shimshon's really even a Nazir, but Ayin Sham, we talked about that last year. I want to talk about something else in the story of Shimshon, which is going to lead us actually back to Sefer Bereishit in a curious way. Shimshon is the most famous riddler in Tanakh, because as much as the word chida, which means a riddle, shows up here and there in Tanakh, we never actually hear riddles in Tanakh, except for in the case of Shimshon. And his famous riddle is here in purple and yellow, as you can see it. I'll give you the background to this riddle. And what is essentially unfair about the riddle, and yet why the riddle was something that the people he was challenging could solve, and then how he fooled them, how misled them. And understanding this is going to take us to an interesting place in Sefer Bereishit. So put on your seatbelts, here we go. The story of Shimshon starts, he's born in the previous Perek, and he's a powerful guy, but we don't really hear much about him, except that he's a powerful guy. And this is the story, Perek Yudalad, which really starts the story of Shimshon himself. If you have the source sheet, you can see the English underneath. I'm going to keep the Hebrew on top so that we can read from it. Vayered Shimshon v'aviv v'imo timnata. Now, the background of this is that Shimshon sees a plishti girl and falls in love with her. And Chazal make no bones about it. He lusted after her with his eyes. And he begged his parents to go arrange a marriage. It tells us a whole lot about what's going on. And by the way, his parents' reaction is really instructive. They don't say, how can you marry a non-Jewish girl? They can't. They don't even say, how can you marry a girl from the enemy, oppressing nation? Rather, they say, how come you don't marry somebody from Shevet Dan? Or at least somebody who's Jewish. That seems to be the sense of what they say. And he insists he wants to marry her because he likes her. So they agree, which is pretty strange. And his parents, who, by the way, at least his mom seems to be a very righteous lady. She had nevuah. She had a malach come to her. That's quite a powerful thing. And nonetheless, she agrees to help arrange his marriage with a plishti girl. And in the background, what's lurking, and we'll see this play out, is that nobody here knows that this is something that God has planned in order to create tension between Shimshon and the plishtim, because there is no more assured way of creating a battle than to have the two sides marry each other, right? And Dai L'Chacham. Now, so Shimshon now comes down to Timnah, which is Plishti territory. It's, by the way, in the territory of Shevet Yehuda. And by the way, this is very early in the period of the Shoftim. It's not where it is chronologically. Sefer Shoftim is not at all chronological because at this point, Dan has not yet conquered the northern territory. So this is early in the period of Shoftim where Dan does not really have territory. They're kind of living, slumming it off of Yehuda. And so Shimshon and his family come down. Now, this is critical to understand what goes on. They come to the vineyards of Timnah. A lion suddenly is roaring and is going to attack Shimshon. Now, Shimshon is going through the vineyard. Now, keep this in mind. This goes back to what we talked about last year about Shimshon, whether or not he was a Nazir. So Hashem's spirit came on him. Rambam defines this as what he calls Ruach Hashem. This is the lowest level of nevuah. This is extra power. And he rips it apart just like you and I would rip a goat apart. I'm not sure how we read that. Without any weapon. But he never told his parents. Now, later on in the story, we'll see in a second, nobody knows what happened here that he killed this lion. And which means he's all alone, but he was going with his parents. So where are his parents? So what seems pretty clear is that his parents avoided the Karam. Why did his parents avoid the Karam? Because his parents have to avoid drinking wine as per the instructions given to them. He can go through the Karam. All right, so that's something, again, we talked about last year. They come down and everything is settled for the wedding. So now they're going to come back for the wedding. Shimshon comes down to get married to her. This is a year later, Miyamim. He then goes off the path to go see where that lion carcass, what's going on with the carcass of the lion. Inside of the lion's carcass, there is an active beehive with honey. Shimshon is gibor, so he just sticks his hand right in, without the mask, without anything. And he's walking, and you kind of get a picture of a little bit of a slob. He's walking, and as he's walking, he's eating honey. He comes to his parents. Now, where were his parents? So again, when they went back down to Timnah, his parents had to take the other route around the vineyard. He goes through the vineyard. He sees the line, and he takes the honey. You'll see that they don't know anything about this. He gives his parents some honey. He doesn't tell them that it came from the lion's carcass. All right, maybe for whatever reason, but that means they don't know about it. Okay. Now, the parents are at the wedding, and they make a feast. By the way, a feast always means wine, and Shimshon is sponsoring this. So now the people see Shimshon come. They take 30 men who become his appointed entourage. So evidently the custom then was that the out-of-town groom has to have some sort of an entourage. And if he doesn't have one, we'll provide one for you. We'll provide from the bride's family, the bride's townsfolk, an entourage. Oh, very nice. Now they're at the feast, and Shimshon says, "Achuda na lachem chida. I will riddle you a riddle." So, by the way, you see that they had a full week of celebration. We heard about that, by the way, in Lavan's case also, even much earlier. They had a 7-day week, 7 days of celebration. And the celebration was ongoing for 7 days. It wasn't like, you know, a dinner at 6 o'clock at a restaurant and we'll all meet there. It was ongoing for 7 days. And so if you can figure out and solve this riddle during the week, I will owe you 30 garments, 30 suits, as it were. But if you can't solve it, then you have to pay me 30. In other words, either I'm going to provide each one of you with a suit of clothes, or else each one of you is going to provide me with a suit of clothes. We don't know what Shimshon's going to do with 29 extra suits. That's a different problem. So they say, okay, riddle us your riddle and let's hear it. Right? So now, that's where we're going. Now, Vayomalam, here's the riddle. The riddle reads, Meha Ochel, and I'm putting so that you can see the English too, Meha Ochel Yatsam Ma'achal. Umeaz Yatsam Matok. 6 words, that's the whole riddle. Meha Ochel Yatsam Ma'achal. Umeaz Yatsam Matok. Right? From the eater came food, and from az, which we think means strong, came sweet. Okay? Now, long story short, they couldn't solve it for the first 3 days. Finally, by the end of the week, they're frustrated out of their minds. They think that they've been set up, and that they're being invited to become part of his entourage was all an elaborate ruse on the part of his father-in-law to rob them of things. And so they threaten the girl that if she can't get the answer out of him, they're going to kill her. And so she begs and begs and begs and begs. And just before the end of the last day, he breaks down. By the way, that's Shimshon's Achilles heel. That use of that word was deliberate. Shimshon's Achilles heel. He just can't say no to women. It's what ultimately gets him his fatal haircut. And just at the end of the day, he tells her the answer. And what's the real answer to the riddle? The real answer to the riddle is that I got honey out of a lion. A lion is a predator, is an eater. And I got from the eater, I got food. And from the strong one, I got sweet. Okay, that's the solution to the riddle. And so their answer back is, Mamatok midvash, ume'az me'ari. What is as sweet as honey, and what is as strong as a lion? Now, there's only one way they could have gotten that information, which is that they knew the background story. So let's roll it back. Shimshon was being extremely unfair. This is an unfair riddle, because a riddle, by definition, is something that anybody in the audience, using imagination, using logic, using sensitivity to words, can solve. But it can't include missing data, because if the missing data is vital for solving it, it's not a fair riddle. And so if you think about it, his riddle is unfair, and their reaction is appropriate in getting enraged that he's using information that nobody else has to give the riddle, and that then they coerce it out of her, and he gets angry back at them, because he knows that there's only one way they could have solved it, and that is by getting it out of his wife, because he knows that 5 minutes earlier she'd gotten it out of him. So he says another 6-word epigram, Lulei charashtem be'egalati lo metzatem chidati. Had you not plowed with my calf, you would not have solved the riddle. In other words, if you not harassed my young wife, you would not have solved it. All right, and then he gets angry, and he goes off to Ashkelon, a nice Plishti city. He kills 30 Plishtim, which means, by the way, God's plan is working, takes their suits, pays off the debt, and goes home in a huff. All right, that's that story. How the story continues, it's really interesting, but we're not going to deal with that today. Question is, was his riddle really unsolvable? Now, the reason I ask that is that you can have a riddle which is able to be solved, but not necessarily the way that the original person intended it. Meaning, you can have a solution to the riddle which is correct and answers all of the demands of the riddle, and it's not the one the person had in mind. could this riddle have been solved some other way within reason? So think about it. Let's say just the first half. Meha ochel yatsa ma'achal. How would you solve that?
I'll see if I can send you an email. Hold on.
How would you solve that? Meha ochel yatsa ma'achal. How would you solve that? Meha ochel yatsa ma'achal. From the eater came food. So I'll tell you a little story about this, just to show you how much you have to really be vigilant. The answer is quite simple. The answer is a chicken and an egg. A chicken eats, and out of the chicken comes an egg. Very simple solution. Years ago, I was sharing this idea at a shul back east. I won't say which shul, I won't say where back east. And somebody sitting there with an air of absolute authority said, "Not true. Eggs were not used for eating until the Roman times." And he said it like that. And the whole place just quiet. And I looked at him and said, "Okay, that's a possible solution. I mean, there is another solution to this, which is honey. Honey itself. Meha ochel yatsa ma'achal. Because bees devour, and yet from bees come honey. But that's a little bit stretchy, because it doesn't really come out of the bee." Okay. By the way, right after Shabbos, we went on Google and we found out eggs have been eaten thousands of years before this story happened. So you got to really be careful when somebody says something with the air of authority. You know, always come back with Rabbi Google and see what happens. In any case, but this is something that could have been solved. It could have been solved easily. So why didn't they answer it? I don't mean answer it correctly. I mean, why didn't they answer it accurately? Eggs. Eggs come from chickens. So Dr. Moshe Zeidel, an article he wrote many, many years ago, suggested that what misled them was the second half. If he had only said me'ochel yatsa ma'achal without knowing anything about the line, they could have solved it. Again, not what he had in mind, but a solution is a solution. You still get your 30 suits. But what else did they say? Me'az yatsa matok. He said me'az. Now, what does the word az mean? And this is where language is so critical. And this is where an equivoque becomes so valuable. A word that has two different meanings, and you don't say what the meaning is, can really play a role. What does the word az with an ayin mean? What's az? So az can mean strong, as in oz, and az can also mean very sharp, something pungent, right? Right, and both words are used in Tanakh. The word is used both ways in Tanakh. Now, meha ochel yatsa ma'achal. What's the relationship between an ochel and a ma'achal?
Ma'achal is food.
An ochel is eater, which means they are opposites. Ochel and ma'achal are opposites. Which means when you look at me'az yatsa matok, you figure, and that's why I color coded in that way. Az must be the opposite of matok. What is matok? Sweet. So az must take which meaning?
Sour.
Sour, sharp, harif. And that's what misled them. They couldn't solve it. Because these six words together, the two pieces together, the second half misled them, and they couldn't see the first half because of the second half. As they said, me'az yatsa matok, aha, what is it that's sweet, but it comes from something sour, can't solve it. And the only reason they thought az meant something sour is because of the first half. The reality was, of course, that he didn't mean az that way. He meant az as strong. Now, here's the proof in the pudding. When they give their solution, look at the purple with the yellow text. When they give their solution, what do they focus on? They don't focus on the first half of the riddle. They focus on the second half. Ma matok midvash u'me'az mi'ari. They talk about matok and az. And their point is that they got it, that az here didn't mean sharp, it meant strong. Nothing is sweeter than honey, and nothing is stronger than a lion. And aha, we gotcha. And that's why he's so angry, because, although in a sense, he's being angry in an unfair way, because the only way to properly solve this riddle was if they had information that they couldn't have. However, they could have solved the riddle had they seen around his ruse. See, we don't think of Shimshon as that much of a bright guy. We think of him as a strong guy, but not necessarily as a brilliant rhetorician. But here he is. And had they been able to see around that ruse, they would have solved it on their own. Incorrectly, but solved it on their own. But because of the way he set up the riddle, they thought Oz meant sour or sharp. They couldn't find anything. They got to the wife. They coerced the wife, and the wife turned around and told them, and that was the solution. And that's what got him so angry, and go on and on. The reason that this, as I said, could take us back to Bereishit is because there is a very strong relationship between a chidah, a riddle, and a chalom, in the sense of not a chalom meaning a dream a la Freud, but a dream as prophecy. Dreams in Tanakh are often dealt with. As a matter of fact, I can't think of any dreams that we have mentioned in Tanakh that are not in some sense prophetic. Whether it's the dream of Yosef's two dreams, the dreams of the butler and the baker, the dreams of Paro, that's easy. Whether or not it's the dream that Gidon overhears the Midianite warriors sharing with themselves, with each other, right? Whether it's the dreams that Nebuchadnezzar has, these dreams are all seen as prophetic, they're a message from God. But dreams and riddles have something in common. And what do they have in common? Well, first of all, they're joined together in a very famous passage that we have dealt with from different angles many times. And that is the passage at the end of Balotcha when Hashem rebukes Aaron and Miriam for the way that they spoke about Moshe and about their own nevuah. And he says,
I'm on with you. I've been on. You don't see me?
Right. Shimuna Dvarai. Imiya Neviachem Adonai. Bamara Elav Et Vada Bachalom Adaber Bo. So now, Hashem says, if I give you a Navi, I will appear to him in a vision or in a dream. And then, contrasting that with Moshe, he says, Lo chen abdi Moshe. That's not true for Moshe. Bechol beitin emanhu. Very trusted in my house, whatever that may mean. Pe el pe adaber bo. I speak to him mouth to mouth, straight to straight. Umar'eh velo v'chidot. In a vision, meaning straight vision, and not with riddles. So you see that riddles and dreams are comparable here, are analogous here, as things which are not clear. Why are they not clear? Because both dreams and riddles appear in symbolic language, meaning you have to interpret them to understand what's going on. Shimshon didn't say, tell me which strong animal I beat up. He uses a riddle in order to see if they can get past it. Think about how riddles work. And he said, and by the way, dreams appear as riddles, that we have to solve them. What do you mean by that? So I want to take you to the most famous dreams in Tanakh. And the most famous dreams in Tanakh that set the course for Jewish history, I think fairly clearly, are Paro's two dreams. Because Paro's two dreams, of course, are what launched Yosef out of jail, what launched Yosef to the position of viceroy of Egypt, are what brings the entire family down, are what leads the family to become the elite in society of Egypt, and then ultimately to be subjugated, and the rest, of course, is all of Jewish history, it's Yet Mitzrayim. So let's take a look. Paro has a dream. Now, the question I want to pose here is, how was Yosef able to resolve Paro's dreams, and nobody else could? Nobody else, all of his master dream interpreters couldn't solve them. See, when the butler and baker have their dreams, well, we don't know who else is in jail who could solve them. But here, Paro's got a whole staff. Why can't they solve it? So let's take a look at the dream. Vahimi kech shnatayim yamim, it's source 3. Ufaro cholem v'nei omed al hayor. Right? Paro is dreaming. He sees himself at the banks of the Nile. V'nei min hayor alot sheva parot yifot mara v'yot pasar v'atirana ba'achu. And he sees 7 beautiful cows come out of the river. And they graze among the reeds. V'hine shema parot acherot olot acharein min hayor. Now another 7 cows come up. Ra'ot marev dakot basar. They look all scrawny. They stand next to the fat cows. And the skinny ones ate the fat ones, and Paro woke up. He went back to sleep. Had a second dream. Seven stalks are growing healthy. Seven that are weak and emaciated and have the wind blow them off. Grow after them. All right, and so the skinny ones ate up the fat ones, and Paro woke up. Now here are the words I underlined. What does v'hinei chalom mean? Behold, it is a dream. Keep that in mind. In the morning, he was all shook up. He tells all of his advisors, and nobody could solve it for him. Okay. So then, the intervening psukim, the Sar Mashkin, comes and tells the story, and there was this Jewish kid, a Hebrew kid, and he solved the dreams, and they pull Yosef out, and he's 30 years old, and they shave him, and he stands before Paro. Okay. And now Paro tells Yosef the story. By the way, Yosef, Paro Yosef, what does he say? Bachalomi, in my dream, singular. I'm standing on the banks. He describes the dream as we heard it. And at the end he says, Va'era bachalomi, and I saw in my dream. And we hear the second part with the stalks. Va'omar lachatumim vein magidli, and nobody could tell me. Now, Va'yomi Yosef al Paro, chalom Paro echadhu. What's the first thing Yosef says after he hears the whole thing before he interprets it? Paro's dream is one. There's one dream here. And then he says that the Asher Elohim Osehi Gid the Faro. This is a prophetic dream. God is telling you what's going to happen. And then he says, seven good years, seven bad years. What did he solve? So notice that he then describes what Paro saw and what it means. God is showing you what he's going to do. And 7 years of plenty are coming. And 7 years of famine are coming afterwards. And the whole good years are going to be forgotten because the famine will destroy the land. And the years of plenty will be forgotten. And then he adds, why did Paro have the dream twice? Because God's going to make it happen very fast. What does that mean? So Sadia Gaon, in a commentary on Mishlei, as you see it at the bottom, makes the following comment. First, just one note here. The Sforno, and just about everybody agrees with this, is that we are trying to identify what it was that the other advisors couldn't see. Because, by the way, once we hear the interpretation, it's just like some no-brainer. Seven fat cows, seven lean cows, right? The Sforno makes the following comment. He says, "Ein potero tam mipnei shechashvu shehem shnayim." They thought there were two different dreams here, the cow dream and the stalk dream, and they interpreted different ways. And therefore, they got the interpretation wrong. What was Yosef's first thing that he said? This is a single dream. And the reason that it came twice is because it's going to happen very fast. Okay. Now, what is it that Yosef actually said? So, Sadia Gaon, in a commentary in Sefer Mishlei, on the word militza, which is another word for sort of a rhetorical twist. He says that what Yosef did is he said to Paro, the way you reported the dream was misleading. Remember what we had with Shimshon, is the way that he said things misled the plishtim and they couldn't solve it. What Yosef says is the way that you told this dream is misleading and you can't solve it. But I'm going to rearrange it for you. I'm going to tell you what you really saw. And Yosef knew this because Yosef understood about dreams. And Chazal later on, and you see it in source 4, make the following comment. They say a person can never see in their dreams something that is not real. Meaning, you could see a person fly because you know what flying is, you know what a person is. But you will never see, Chazal say, a golden date tree or an elephant going through the head of a needle, the eye of a needle. You'll never see something that's not realistic, right? So Yosef says, let's think about what Paro told me. He said that I saw 7 fat cows come out and then get eaten up by 7 skinny cows. Can I ask you a question? Have you in your life, Paro, or anybody else, ever seen a cow eat a cow? Cows are herbivores. They don't eat cows. Besides the problem of a skinny cow eating a fat cow, cows don't eat cows. But it gets much more difficult when you get to the what we think is the second dream. In the second dream, what did he supposedly see? Stalks eating stalks. Stalks don't eat. So you know what Yosef said to Paro? He said, you mistold the dream. That's not what you saw. It was one single dream. And that's why when Paro told him, he said, and in my dream I saw. Meaning it's one dream, not two dreams. He said, you know what you saw? First, you saw 7 fat cows eating 7 fat stalks. And then you saw 7 skinny cows eating 7 skinny stalks. Rearrange the information and it makes sense. And it is one single dream. And so therefore, the dream is that there's going to be 7 years of plenty. Fat cows eating fat stalks. And this, by the way, speaks exactly to the agronomy of Egypt. They grew, they raised cows there, and the cows there were used not for meat. There's every reason to think that the Egyptians were even vegetarians, but for plowing. And they raised grain. And that, by the way, is Lower Egypt and Upper Egypt, and the symbols that were on the pharaohs, etc., of those two economies. And so the fat cows eating fat grain, that's years of plenty. And the skinny cows eating skinny grain and emaciated grain, that's the years of famine. And so Yosef turns around and says, you just mistold it. And so by reordering how you presented it, we're able to solve it. This chalom is a chida. This dream, not dreams, but dream, is a riddle. And Yosef was able to unpack the riddle and solve it by moving the information around, much as the plishtim would have been able to do had they not seen past Shimshon's ruse. Now, the critical difference is in the case of Shimshon, of course, they were deliberately misled, and Shimshon was trying to get them to not be able to resolve it. In the case of Yosef, Paro himself was confused. He wasn't deliberately trying to mistell the dream, but notice, from his perspective, it's a single dream. So he got confused and put the parts in the wrong order, put the cows together and the stalks together, and as a result of it, it was a dream that was not able to be solved. Yosef simply said, you put the material back in the order that you actually saw it, and you'll get it. And that's why Paro's immediate reaction is, Ein navon, en navon v'chacham kamocha. Because Paro's reaction to Yosef isn't good shot, it's there is nobody as brilliant as you. It's not his brilliance of interpretation, it's his brilliance in seeing past what Paro mistold and reporting the dream correctly. So we go from Shimshon, a hero who is perhaps a failed hero in the company and the wedding feast of the Plishtim, to Yosef, who is a true hero, who of course succeeds in the court of Egypt. And so hopefully we got a little better insight and to the nature both of riddles and also of the way that language can be used to lead, to mislead. And if we can see past it, then we can solve the